Whigs and Tories before 1832. The Whigs. The fall of Pitt in 1801, after his failure to carry through a measure of Catholic emancipation, brought the Foxite Whigs flooding back to Westminster. The crisis enabled them to group round one of their old rallying cries, the undue influence of the Crown. The political stalemate that had characterised the years from 1794 to 1801 was evaporating with the fall of Pitt. A new opposition group emerged, opposed to the new leader in the peace negotiations. It was only a small group, but contained men of immense talent and reputation. The fragmentation of the Pittite party in the Commons owes much to the intransigence of George III, as well as the ability of the Whig party to renew itself. Pitt returned to power in 1804, but it was in very different circumstances to his previous ministries. The resignation of the Pittites after Pitt's death following an unhappy and unsuccessful short ministry in 1806 left George III once more with no alternative but to turn to the Whig party for a ministry. He attempted to negotiate with Grenville alone, but Grenville refused, and the so-called Ministry of All the Talents was elected, a government in the tradition of Rockingham. Grenville appointed his own cabinet, including six Foxites. Addington, now Viscount Sidmouth, also sat in the cabinet as a concession to the king, but this could not disguise the fact that this was no court administration. Ministerial replacements were more complete than at any time since 1783. The ministry, though, was ill-starred. There were contradictions and inconsistencies over policy, particularly concerning the war with France. But more importantly was the public perception of the Foxites' neglect, once in power, of their fundamental creed, that of eliminating secret influence and reform. With Fox's death in the autumn of 1806, the heart was lost from the ministry, and it was dissolved in March 1807, again over the issue of Roman Catholic emancipation. The 1807 election, though, did bring into Parliament for the first time a small but vociferous group of radicals. At Westminster, the radical candidates, Sir Francis Burdett and Lord Cochrane, were elected instead of Sheridan, a leading Foxite. Their chief spokesman in the Commons was Samuel Whitbread. In general, the radicals pressed for peace and for reform. Whitbread put through a bill to reform the Poor Law, which was defeated, but his bill for compulsory education passed through the Commons only to be defeated in the Lords. The radical section within the Whig party revitalised it, and by 1812 it had emerged from the doubts that had riven it during the French Revolution and was now firmly committed to parliamentary and social reform. From 1812 to 20, the Whigs again exploited their chances in opposition to emerge as the champions of public opinion. They opposed the Property Acts. They resisted the government's repressive measures in 1817, the so-called Six Acts, which followed rural rioting in East Anglia, the Spa Field riots in London, an attempt on the life of the Prince Regent, and Luddism in the factory towns. They were, however, still unwilling to be associated with popular agitators, although this changed with Peterloo in 1819 and saw the Whigs adopt a far more aggressive approach to opposition. In 1820, they capitalised on the wave of popular sympathy for Queen Caroline, following the divorce bill and the new king's attempts to exclude her from the kingdom. Nevertheless, in the last analysis, the Whigs were unable to remove the government of Lord Liverpool. But these years were important in the development of the Whig party. It emerged from the trials and tribulations of the 1790s with all the elements that were to characterise the period. The party during the 19th century. Essential to this was the idea of individual freedom and a commitment to political liberty. However, the party had not equipped itself to deal with many of the extra political issues of the time, such as economic reform, factory reform, the condition of the working classes, universal education, and Britain's approach to her empire. The Tories. When did the Tory party come into being? This question has vexed historians of the pre-reformed electoral system since the great Whig historians of the 19th century first started their analysis. The controversy has continued up to the present day, with opinions as diverse as O'Gorman, who believes that a definite two-party system emerged before 1832, and Namier and Clark, who have argued that it's impossible to apply the post-1832 titles of Whig and Tory to the fluid groups that existed in the late 18th and early 19th century. There appear to be three separate arguments about the development of a Tory party. One, that it had developed as a result of the polarisation of politics caused by the crisis of the 1830s. Two, that it developed following the death of Pitt, thus the ministry of Lord Liverpool could be described as the first Tory government. Or three, that the origins of the Tory party actually predated the death of Pitt and in fact owed much to the policies of that man. Pitt himself is still very much an enigma to historians of the period. He was Prime Minister for much of his adult life, yet his war ministries were not particularly successful, relying on coercion of the populace at large. Although he won the support of voters in successive general elections, the Whigs could claim the high ground. He was very much a popular politician, appealing for the support of the public rather than the commons. Pitt's most effective successor was Lord Liverpool, who succeeded the brief ministries of Portland and Percival to remain in office until 1827. The former were very much associates of Pitt, and even the Ministry of Liverpool was made up of mostly of Pittite personnel. The government of Liverpool was the first to adopt the party label and allow itself to be described as a Tory government. Party feeling came into increased prominence during Liverpool's administration. The issue of the royal prerogative faded as successive cabinets began to bypass the views of the Prince Regent. But the issue of what to do with public opinion intensified greatly. Liverpool argued that he as Prime Minister was in the best position to judge the real interest of the nation. Parliament should follow the recommendations of the government rather than the demands of public opinion. In many ways, the coming of peace after Wellington's victory at Waterloo in 1815 created many more problems than it solved for the Tories. Peace released the Whigs from the accusations of unpatriotism and allowed them to concentrate on domestic issues. The war had caused an unbalancing of the economy. The price of corn slumped, and there was an economic depression. The ministry did not anticipate the challenge by the masses after the war, and it was unable, especially after Peterloo, to coerce them into submission. Liverpool's cabinet was probably the first to lose the label aristocratic, and again, this was to have important consequences for the future of the Tory party. Increasingly, throughout the 19th century, the Whigs began to be the party associated with the landed aristocracy, leaving the Tories as the representatives of property and the middle classes. Liverpool's administration was probably at its strongest at its beginning and its end. It suffered a tremendous blow with the defeat of the property tax legislation in 1816. This defeat demonstrated the lack of communication by the government with its supporters in the Commons. The transition to the so-called liberal Toryism of the 1820s was not an abrupt process. There was a steady pursuit of economic reform through Liverpool's administration and a growing interest in legal reform. Liverpool's government introduced reforms, though slowly and cautiously. The achievements of the Liberal Tories should not be overestimated. Apart from their introduction of moderately freer trade and Peel's legal reforms, their main achievements were that they reduced the expense of government to the minimum and rationalised the central administration. The Tory governments of the 1820s were above all held by desire only to present reforms that would have the widest possible acceptance. Change had to be carefully regulated. The rights of vested interests had to be respected. We turn again then to an assessment of the period as one which saw the development of the Tory party. As has already been mentioned, it is possible to see the Pittites as the real fathers of Toryism. Although whilst Pitt was alive and in government, they could not be described as a party akin to the Foxites. Liverpool's government, though, was the one that really moved forward the development of Toryism and the Tory party. The government began to be described as Tory by the popular writers, the press and even backbenchers. More and more members accepted the government whip. As far as Tory ideology goes, though, there is little movement from the ideas of Pitt amongst administrations of the early 19th century. And government policies did not differ much from the policies of Pitt. Both administrations depended on coercion and control of the lower orders of society to get their measures through. Thus, in policy, ideology and personnel, the Tory governments post-1807 were successors to the Pittite administrations of the 1780s and 1790s. Perhaps the last word on whether the Tories existed as a distinct party or not before 1832 should go to that arch-Tory, Lord Wellington. He declared in 1828 that he could not see any difference between the Whigs and the Tories. In a way, he was right. For example, all Whigs did not favour parliamentary reform, and the issue of Catholic emancipation cut across party lines. It was therefore to be in response to the fractures caused by the reform crisis that the two distinct creeds were truly to mature.